All right, welcome into another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, along with Cherry Coolidge. Glad to be back for episode, what is this, Phil? Episode 42? 41.
I thought we were starting to count when I came on. No.
Cherry, how you doing?
Hi, everyone. episode 6 for those who are counting.
Episode 6 for Cherry. So an episode 41 overall in our season. Thank you so much for listening. Our listenership is going up and up and up. We have had some great guests in recent weeks. Thanks to Rich Grader, Grader CEO, coming in last week. Great listenership on that. If you missed that last week, go back and listen to the Grader's Ice Cream CEO talking about all things ice cream. It was a fun episode. It was a fun interview. I thought it was I just thought it was one of the best interviews we've done yet, and I'm not bragging about that. I just thought that he was great, and I'm appreciative of all of our guests coming on today.
The Coolidge boys are thrilled. There's been a lot of Graders coming in through the house.
I've had a little bit of it myself.
Trying all those bonus flavors.
It's great.
We're a team key lime pie now.
Yeah,
we like it.
I'm actually, I need to try the vanilla. I know that sounds boring, but... that was Rich Grader's favorite flavor.
Classic.
I've actually never tried Grader's vanilla ice cream. So anyway, let's cut to the chase here. Our guest today, another exciting guest, Hamilton County GOP Chairman Alex Triantafilou is on to talk about the 2020 race. It's already heating up. The local Republican Party has a big rally this weekend and marks 500 days out from the November 2020 election. And as we've written about several times and reported on Cincinnati.com is that the Democrats continue to take control of Hamilton County, and the Republicans are making efforts to try to stem the tide a little bit. It's going to be tough with Trump back on the ballot again in 2020, but we're looking forward to talking to Alex about some things they have coming up to try to see what they can do in 2020. Let's first of all, in our opening segment here, we're sticking with the tradition here. A new tradition is that we're bringing in someone from our newsroom here in the opening segment. So we welcome in Inquirer reporter extraordinaire Dan Horn.
Hi, guys. Dan. Thanks for having me.
Is that all you have to say today, Dan?
I like the intro.
I think Jason forgot a key word before the intro. You know. Pulitzer Prize winning.
Oh,
yeah. Me and 50 Inquirer other people
reporter
here.
Extraordinaire. Dan
he always
Horn.
Says that, but Dan and Terry really drove yes. our Pulitzer Prize winning story seven
in 2017.
Days of Heroin, and it was amazing. And so, like, we like to rib Dan a little bit about.
It's great
that.
To have Dan back on the hot seat here. Dan, right now you're working on a project called The Road, and we are what now? And we've
part
had
two.
We're in part two, right?
We just finished part two.
Yeah. That's right.
Yep.
Where basically you're looking at, you're looking at, poverty along basically from Middletown all the way down the I-75 kind of Route 4 Vine Street corridor down into Cincinnati. And then, at some point you guys are going to be writing and reporting on that corridor all the way down to Falmouth, Kentucky.
Right. Right. Yeah. Basically, if you stand on Vine Street in downtown Cincinnati and head north to Middletown or south to Falmouth, that's the area we're focused on. And we're just trying to look at people who are struggling economically despite the recovery that we're in now. Some of those folks never really recovered from the recession. That was kind of part one. What we just looked at in part two was, you know, what does it look like? What does that struggle look like every day when you've got to, you know, spend 80% of your income on food and shelter when you've got to haul laundry in a garbage bag to a laundromat 5 blocks away every day. I mean, what does that look like and feel like? And so that's kind of where we're at right now in part two.
Can you, I know we had you and Carol Motzinger on, who you've been teaming up with on this, as well as Max Lonberg and a handful of other editors and reporters and photographers. Can you remind the listeners why this project and why you thought it was so important to do?
Well, it started, our editor, Burl Love, was interested in exploring specifically why the poverty rates in Hamilton County and Cincinnati, city of Cincinnati, were as high as they were. Yep. And that kind of expanded as we went north and south to look at these, some of these broader issues of not just people who live below the poverty line, but people who live around the poverty line or the middle class who are struggling in ways that they hadn't really struggled before the recession. So it kind of covers a wide range of folks. This is not just people who are impoverished. It's people who are struggling. And mm-hmm. sometimes those people, as a lot of our listeners know, middle-class folks with two working adults in the house can still be struggling despite, you know, a lot of the good things going on.
You know, but you told, you know, there's a lot of statistics and there's some bigger overarching stories, but, you know, I texted you, you know, over the weekend, you grabbed me with the story that you wrote about the Titans.
Right.
High school baseball team. I wanted to talk about that because sure. I think these kids' amazing story and their coach, who's everything to them, you know, tells the tale.
That yeah. Yeah, these guys, you know, we found them. This is one of the stories in part two, which includes about a dozen stories. This is the last story in that in part two. And as part of trying to show what this struggle looks like, we've looked around and found a school that is not particularly wealthy. It's a, you know, it's a challenged district. St. Bernard Elmwood Place has 1 in 5 people there live below the poverty line. Their median income is about 20% lower than national average. So this is a district that has a lot of people struggling in it. And so I was interested in trying to find out what happens if you're trying to do something that a lot of us did growing up, playing on a baseball team or running a football team or something like that. And so we found a baseball coach who was recently hired at St. Bernard Elmwood Place, and he took over a program that had not won a game in 3 years. They've been outscored about 570-70 in that time. So not only were they losing, but they were not losing in a real pretty way. And so there's a lot of frustration. The athletic director wanted to try to make a change. The kids were getting frustrated. So they brought in Fred James. He's the coach Sherry mentioned. And he used to play some minor league ball. He's coached at a number of programs around the area, including Walnut Hills High School, which is a very different situation, one of Cincinnati's most elite college prep schools. And so he came in and took over the program and realized pretty early on that his biggest problem is not just coaching baseball, because a lot of these kids hadn't played organized baseball until they got to high school. There's no JV program here. There's no freshman program. There's no middle school program. A lot of these kids just had not played organized ball until they got to high school and Fred recruited them. You know, the kids, some of the kids didn't have the proper gloves. Some of them wore football cleats to practice on the first day. You know, and a lot of them come from backgrounds that, you know, are not ideal. And, you know, they brought some of that baggage with them too. And Fred had to deal with that too. And so this story just kind of took a look at what that's like and how you manage a team that's dealing with a lot more than just trying to win a baseball game.
I think that's important when we're dealing with things like this, because you forget and you're like, oh, well, this team lost for 3 years. But this is the why.
Right.
You know, in a city that has as much poverty as we do, it is an undercurrent of many things, like kids who are acting out or problems in school. And we talk about these things in different kinds of stories. But the underlying thing is they might be hungry.
Yeah.
You know, they're coming from not ideal backgrounds. And it's like it is a current that runs under the city in so many things. And I like when we bring it out and tell people, you know, what's underneath and like the people that are helping. I mean, this coach is amazing. Like he takes their uniforms home and washes
he
them.
Does,
like
yeah.
That's above and beyond. And
yeah.
like,
here, buy them.
You just know, do what you have to do.
Yeah. And he's made an effort to try to create a booster system so they can feed the kids before games, because otherwise they wouldn't eat. He, as you said, he'll take their uniforms home and wash them just to make sure they're clean for the next game.
And he got them new uniforms.
Yep.
And I think that probably, you know, spoke to their pride of going on the field when they play against these teams that have more.
You know, one of these kids had worn the same uniform his dad wore about 20 years earlier. So
wow.
That's when Fred knew he had to do something like get new uniforms. But it's a struggle. And, you know, the budget for his team, I think, is about $1,500 a year. And, you know, you look at some of the numbers out there, and there was a recent survey done, and 20% of households in this country spend as much as $12,000 in a single year on a single kid for youth sports. And this team's entire budget was $1,500. And these parents were not spending that kind of money. And it's interesting because they're in a conference, the Miami Valley Conference, that has an interesting divide. You know, you have schools that are very much elite schools, Summit Country Day, Cincinnati Country Day. And then you have schools that struggle, like St. Bernard and Norwood and Lachlan. And so you very much kind of have a have and have not situation there. It's nothing against the schools that are, you know, successful, but, you know, some of these schools have tuition that's $25,000 a year. And, you know, meanwhile, these kids are coming to baseball practice and football cleats. So you have a real dividing line. And Fred saw that. And so the story is kind of about how Fred tries to deal with these day-to-day challenges of competing with schools like that when he's dealing with what he's dealing with.
And that's a... That's a neighborhood or area, St. Bernard, Elmwood Place, that's been hit really hard by the loss of manufacturing jobs. Did you see in this story as you're reporting it, kind of the, I don't know what the right term is, trickle down impact of those loss of manufacturing jobs? This is very prideful manufacturing, working class neighborhood in this city. Or in this region, it's actually its own villages. Were you sensing that? Were you picking that up as you're reporting on this?
Yeah, I mean, these communities have gone through a lot of change just in the last 10 to 20 years. These were never, you know, really wealthy communities, but they were thriving communities in a lot of ways. You know, these were working class communities, as you said, that were supported by industry throughout the Mill Creek Valley there. You had Procter & Gamble had a huge works at Ivorydale.
Yep.
They're mostly out of there now. There are some other smaller manufacturers that have gone in there, but as is the case with a lot of what's happening in American manufacturing, there are jobs, but they pay a lot less. There are fewer jobs. So you've seen this shift from, you know, a working class community in the old school sense in the 1950s to something that's in transition. And they're trying to figure out what they're going to be, just like the schools are trying to figure out what they're going to be going forward. There are still a lot of really good, hardworking people there, but there's less money. You know, there's a lot less income.
Yeah. Dan, thanks. Can you give us a hint on what the next installment of the road project's going to be, and when should we be looking
for
that?
Wait, real quick.
Oh, sorry.
Should I ruin the ending of the story? I don't know. The story has a really good ending. You don't see it coming.
That's fine.
So what's the headline? Tell us what the headline is.
On
the baseball story. It's like 3 years.
3 years and an epic losing streak. They had lost when we picked them up. They had lost about 55 games in a row. And so we went to a couple games, including their 56th and 57th consecutive losses. But they got some good news.
That's right. I think Dan brought them some luck.
At the very end of the season, they pulled out a win, their first win in 3 years.
It's awesome.
Extra innings.
Goosebumps.
Correct. Yeah. So.
Yay, Titans.
So a happy ending for the Titans. Yes.
Be sure to go back and check that out and just, you know, go on our search queue and search St. Bernard, Dan Horn. It's on Cincinnati.com, our Cincinnati.com app. Dan, before we let you go, can you tease out kind of the next installment of the road project, and when should we be looking for that?
Yeah, we're literally going down the road. So we started up in Middletown, headed south to about Tri-County Mall for part one, then from there down to St. Bernard for part two, and part three will take us from there down through the urban core of Cincinnati and into Covington a bit, and then the final part four, which will come at the end of the year, will run through the suburbs and rural Kentucky. But we will stretch into Kentucky. So the next stretch is basically the urban core of Cincinnati and Covington.
Any idea when that's going to be on, when people can be looking on for that on Cincinnati.com? Okay, mid-September.
Apparently Jason thinks we're better planners than we are. It's kind of funny. You work in the same newsroom we do, right?
And then the finals, I mean, it's all going to be within this year, right?
Yep. Yeah, okay. Then the last one will come out, I think, the first week of December.
Gotcha.
Somebody has a date somewhere. I don't have that date, but yeah, somewhere around there.
You know, this is a good time for me to give a plug for getting a digital subscription to Cincinnati.com. These are the kind of projects that you can only do with your support. And we're the only people in town doing this. Local journalism is so important. So I don't care if you call it a shameless plug or not, but consider a subscription to Cincinnati.com because no one else is doing these kinds of deep dives into how what affects your community and your region. So, Dan, thanks again for stopping in.
Thank you, guys.
Now let's shift to our guest, Alex Giantafula, and let's bring him in. Okay, interview time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. It's a pleasure to welcome in Hamilton County Republican Party chairman, longtime chairman, Alex Giantafula, otherwise known as Alex T. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to be with both of you.
Good to have you in. We wanted to have you in because it's 2020 is already here, essentially. It's heating up. You've got a big rally this weekend, the GOP 500. First of all, can you just what's goes behind this? Why what's that mean? GOP 500 and the first time you've done this, and talk about the ins and outs of why you're doing this.
Appreciate the chance to talk about it. So this started off, I won't give you the full story, but my wife has an app on her phone that has a countdown, and she was doing a countdown to a particular day that's significant to us, a day we're leaving on a trip, frankly. And I thought, you know, that's interesting. And I put in how many days until the 2019 election and how many days until the 2020 election. And I thought, boy, you know, this is completely my idea. I thought, well, how about a rally 500 days before the 2020 election as a way to get people plugged in? And then I looked at the calendar, and that date happened to fall on a Saturday. And I thought, what better day to do a rally than on a Saturday in June, 500 days before the 2020 election? So that's what it is. It's a rally, guys, that's designed to bring our grassroots team out to get new people plugged in. The message from me, I'm going to MC the event, will be, let's take action. Instead of words, let's do stuff. And I say that a lot to our team. Let's do something and not just, and I post on social media all the time, as both of you know, but it takes a lot more than that. And I'm trying to get people who are active and interested in the GOP and in our cause and in our president, because there are some of those people in Hamilton County. I know that might surprise you guys. I'm joking now, of course, but still, we're going to get those people out. And we're honored to have the Trump National Press Secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, who will be our keynote speaker and our special guest on Saturday morning. So looking good. We've got over 200 RSVPs already. We're hoping to continue to build on that. We've got a plan to get people active, and that's what we're doing on Saturday, June 22nd. Doors open at 10 a.m. at the Sharonville Convention Center.
I mean, there's something to be said for bringing people together to rally them, and like, this is what it's going to look like this time, because the 2016 election was like the election that was different, right? And like, I think both sides learned a lot of lessons coming out of it, that it's not the same old campaigning. Like, social media plays a big part of it. Like, making a name for yourself and being out there. I mean, in Hamilton County, let's face it, like, it's yard signs and festivals. That's old school politicking here. And it still matters, because do not skip those festivals. We all know, right? It matters. But so do all these other things. And I think you have to bring people together to start. Like, this is what it's going to look like going forward. And 500 days seems like a good planning time.
Well, yeah. And you know, look, it's funny you said something that I say often. Every election teaches us a lesson. And it's one of the many reasons I love engaging the political process. I'm a junkie even before I'm a Republican. So I love the whole process. And I think that we learned lessons. And one of the lessons we learned, frankly, from the president was that these big, gigantic rallies and not the kind of, micro-targeted specific campaign, at least not in Southwest Ohio, was a way to win. Now, look, we also know how important it is to reach people at the grassroots level, and we'll do it. But some of what you're seeing us do right now is playing off of what we thought was a success in 2016, at least at the statewide level.
And then, as we've written about and talked a lot, and Scott Wortman just had a story yesterday, our Hamilton County and regional politics reporter, about can the Republicans, make a comeback in Hamilton County? And I think the headline said something like it might be too late. There's no doubt you're doing this to try to not only stem that tide, but try to hold on to the position or the seats that you have right now, starting with, I mean, the top of your top priority is Joe Dieters. Can you talk about, he just raised $500,000 at his campaign launch a couple weeks ago. talk about that race and how big of a deal that is.
Anyone in the county who was not there? I was driving home that night and I saw everyone spilling out of the club. And I was like, that's everyone. That's everyone in the whole county is there right now.
You know, it was an extraordinary political event. I go to a lot of these, as I think both of you know. I cover them pretty extensively on my social media. I go to a lot, and this was a special one. But, you know, the question that you ask is the right one. Look, we're not naive to what's happened in this county. Mm-hmm. We're realistic about what's happened in this county. And, you know, this idea that we're going to turn the county red for the president, we're realistic about that, too. That's the goal. There's no question. As our party's leader, we're fighting for every last vote. But there's two different kind of, there's really two universes in my world. There's this effort to deliver a maximum number of votes to the presidential candidate out of Southwest Ohio and Hamilton County specifically, so we can win Ohio and play our small role, I think a pretty significant role in this electoral map. But then there's the local effort. The local effort is going to have to be different. The demographics have shifted. So, you know, I would summarize what we're doing as a party generally. We did a lot of analysis after 2018. Believe me, a lot of gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands. And I'll figure out some more cliches for you. But the bottom line is we've done all those things. And what we've come out with is that we need to have different kinds of candidates going and doing different things. So it's kind of a two-prong approach. That's an oversimplification, but it really does kind of encapsulate what we're doing. So, you know, you're going to see us rolling out, and Scott Wortman did a very nice job talking about that, and others have as well in the press. We're going to do a better job here of rolling out candidates that look more like Hamilton County. We're going to find candidates who are willing to go and do different things and talk to different groups and spread our message. What we know, and my last point, is that the seats that have been taken by Democrats have tended to be from Democrats who have crossover appeal. So if one looks at Jim Neal, he's got so much crossover appeal, he's got himself a primary opponent in Hamilton County. If you look at Dr. Samarco in the coroner's office, she gets some Republican votes. Denise Driehaus, same. Todd Portune, I can tell you, he picks up a lot of votes on the west side with my friends. So,
Todd's an institution.
Well, he is, and it's high name ID helps as well. But anyway, so we recognize that we need some candidates with crossover appeal. That's a different candidate going different places, and that's our strategy in summary.
You and I have talked a lot about that very, very thing about getting the crossover appeal, and really a lot of your efforts since really 2016 and certainly since 2018 have been to recruit new, more diverse candidates. And you've can you talk about some of those folks? Yeah, I know you have Marcus Thompson running out in Anderson Township for trustee. You have Christy Dukes Davis running for township trustee out in Springfield Township. You got Libby Callen appointed to Common Pleas judge by the governor. These are all new faces in terms of first-time candidates running and being in elected office or running for elected office. That's no accident, right? I mean, you're making a concerted effort to recruit new people.
We certainly are. And look, I just want to, the extent that people want to listen to this, we've been pretty good about this in our history. Just there's been some recent local media that has suggested that, you know, we were just always a party of old white men. Really not true. We've got Judge Melba Marsh, who's a longtime judge, African-American. Judge Skip West was a Republican appointed judge. The first African-American ever in the history of the Hamilton County Board of Elections was not the current chair, Gwen McFarland. In fact, it was Todd Ward put on the Board of Elections by Republicans. So we have some history as a party in diversity and embracing people of color and others, especially female candidates. So anyway, that's just to give myself some equal time on our history. But you're exactly right, Jason. You've identified it. We are looking for those candidates who can have some appeal beyond just your traditional Republican base, because we have to. The demographics have shifted, and we're not running in places like Butler, Warren, and Claremont County. We're running in Cincinnati.
Sticking with candidates have crossover appeal, and there's already so much talk about suburban women crossover voters. When we talk about Blue Ash, how Blue Ash was a traditionally Republican area, but how so many voters went over to Democrats in 2018. Sharonville, very similar. Some of these kind of, I guess, middle ring suburbs here in, you know, I guess outer suburbs in Hamilton County. Big question, but that voter is your battle. And how are you going to win that voter back in 2020?
It goes back to what we've talked about. And again, it depends on which race we're talking about. If we're talking about the presidential race, I have very little to do ultimately with how that goes. And despite what some people think, I'm not telling the president what he ought to tweet, right? But jokes aside, the fact of the matter is we're going to try to find candidates who can actually go out and get that voter, and candidates who deliver a message to that particular voter that resonates. You know, I've been doing this, as you said at the beginning here, for more than a decade. I've been active in local politics for 20 years. You know, I've watched George W. Bush win that voter. I've watched Mitt Romney win that voter. John Kasich, whose name I don't like to utter very often, but Rob Portman, whose name I'm pleased to utter. Rob Portman does very well with that voter. So, yeah. The right kind of message, the right kind of candidate, we can win that voter back. And I'm confident that we're going to continue to do better with that voter than we've done in the last couple of years.
You're in a really interesting position in that Trump, where we saw the rest of the state for the most part go Trump and Republican, it kind of was the reverse here in 2016 and 2018, where Trump hurt the Republicans on the ballot. And as a result, partially as a result, you lost some local seats, or you've lost some local seats when that trend was already starting before the 2016 election. You know, when someone says to you, you know, you're in a tough position because on one hand, that's your party. And so you have to support Trump. But on the other hand, how do you navigate that? Because there's no doubt about it. Trump is hurting. And I'm just talking about Hamilton County Republican Party or Hamilton County Republicans. That's a double-edged sword right now, I think, for your party.
Look, it's advice I have to give candidates. I just came from a meeting of candidates over lunch where I'm asked often about this whole kind of juggling act that you have to do. It's really not necessarily a new phenomenon for us, but it's a tough position, sure. My advice to our candidates is you have to sort of dance with the party that brung you, you know? Yeah. I mean, and we're going to be we're going to support the president. I'm going to support the president. Our party, Faithful, will support the president. Being mindful of the fact that we can still win races with different kind of candidates talking to different kinds of voters. There are ticket splitters in this business, in a political business, I mean, and among voters. It's the rare person who actually goes down the ballot all the way down on one particular side. Political science tells us that. I know that from life experience. Now, I'm a straight party guy, but I think probably one of the few, and people who are listening, they're probably not, everybody is just not a straight party person. So we're going to look for that candidate that'll get you to cross over, and that's how we're going to win some local races. But as a party at large, we're going to support the president.
Let's shift to kind of down the ballot a little bit. And Joe Dieter's certainly your number one priority of keeping him in office, keeping control of the prosecutor's seat, which has been for so long controlled by the Republican Party and has been a farm system for judicial seats with the attorneys coming up through that office. This is a different day for Joe. Obviously, we talk so much about how this county has changed. What are some things Joe has to do differently in 2020 that he's never done before?
Ooh, the advice giving portion of the show. Yeah. Here we go.
Well, I'll say this. I mean, I guess where I would probably quibble a little bit with the question is that I don't know that Joe has to do a lot different in the sense that he's been independent, Jason and Sherry. He's been an independent guy. I mean, it's not too long ago that Republicans were blowing me up about some of the decisions Joe was making, whether it was, you know, pursuing a police officer in a use of force case, something that you don't see too often, coming out.
Legalization of
marijuana. Just about to say that, you know, an issue that's been hot in Cincinnati lately, and that is the legalization of marijuana. Joe is his own man on those issues. And anybody that knows Joe and I think the voters know Joe, there's an established brand. It's an independent brand. Joe's he's some, you know, outspoken, brash in his own way, tells it like it is. And so when you say, will Joe change, I've urged them not to. I think that the brand is what it is, and we're going to have to talk about it, and he's going to have to talk about it and make sure that voters understand that public safety is a key priority, and Joe's the only person that we know of now that's considering running with this level of experience to keep people safe. And he's not afraid to make tough calls, even if it's politically unpopular within his own camp. And, you know, he'll do what he's going to do. So I, again, the answer to the question for me is not a whole lot different, but maybe on the political operations side, social media, you've seen some of that ramp up. You'll see some more digital, just like every other campaign. He'll have to modernize. He's already doing that.
Yeah. And the fact that he comes out and in his first fundraiser, really his campaign launch, reelection, he raises $500,000. That's like we don't see that in a local race. What message does that send to the Democrats, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's an important message. It's a message that we're taking this race very seriously. This was an all hands on deck fundraising effort for Joe. We wanted to get out of the box early. So Joe's been a prodigious fundraiser.
Yep.
And, you know, it's funny, we had one of our statewide Republican candidates at this event. And when he heard the number announced by someone at the dais that night, he said, "But that's pretty good even for a statewide campaign." Yeah. There's some Supreme Court justices who raised that number. So, but you know, we're just getting started. And I know that sounds like some bravado from me, but the fact of the matter is what Joe just did, he'll do it again. We'll get to $1 million, and then there's going to be some independent expenditures that I'm not working on. Joe's not working on, but we know that exists. Yeah. So there'll be some independent money that comes into this race. This will be a focus race, and I think it'll be bigger than, well, I already know it's going to be bigger than Hamilton County. It's important that we have an independent prosecutor.
And for all, sticking with sort of the law and order side of things, the Republicans, for all the talk of the Democratic takeover in the county, the Republicans still, they do not control a majority of the executive seats in the county, but you do control the judicial system. How will we see a coordinated campaign? You have, 13 seats, I believe, are up?
Correct.
And that's judicial seats across various courts. How, what will we see, and what should people expect to see from the Republican Party in terms of the campaign around those seats?
Yeah, you know, we're still working on exactly how that's going to work for 2020, primarily because we haven't figured out who all of our candidates are going to be. There are a couple open seats. That being said, a couple things we have to make sure we do. We have to make sure our people are disciplined all the way down the ballot. And that's something that's a little different for judicial races, and it's unique to the judicial campaigning, and that you really want to make sure people know who they, you know, we want hardcore Republicans to know to finish their ballot and to finish it for our people, because the judges don't have the R or the D indicator on their name on the ballot. So getting people to finish their ballot and identify their Republican judges, I call it Know Your GOP. We've got this GOPjudges.com website that we promote an awful lot. So that's sort of a job one. And then it will also be the second prong of our long-term plan is to go and do different things. We just, we have to get out of our comfort zone. You know, I had one judge I won't name say to me last week, you know, "I don't do Twitter." And I said, "Yeah, then you don't do victory." Now, is Twitter the end all of winning a campaign? No, but if these judges who've been there a long time are tied into these old methods of campaigning, they're going to find themselves in trouble because there are new ways to communicate. So we're going to do things differently and then make sure we get people to be disciplined all the way down the ballot.
It's almost like it's not necessarily what they're saying on Twitter, although you can't make a mistake. That's perilous territory. It's the consciousness. I'm just seeing that tweet come through. Like, oh, that's a judge candidate. And it's like you might not remember what they said in that specific tweet, but then it becomes like part of the consciousness of like people are on it. It's the Facebook too.
You know, from, again, this podcast is great, I think, because it's so insider, but the insider piece of this that we all know, Democrats and Republicans alike, The brand is so much easier in judicial races because it's a name. Mm-hmm. You don't have to talk about raising taxes because you can't take a position. You don't have to talk about weed legalization or any of the, pick the controversial issue of the day. As a judge, you don't have to talk about it. You just have to get your name out there. And so in one sense, it's way easier to be on social media. I get judges say, what can I talk about? You could talk about everything from Cincinnati Reds baseball, which I love to talk about, or you know anything else relating to you and your family, just as long as you drive your name and people get to know who you are. And there's a certain intimidation factor with judges because they just seem to be, you know, they still, I think they're the last remaining political figures that still get some level of respect, right? But for that reason, they need to use social media to advance their name, and that can be done that way.
You know, I like to see their dogs, just like all my friends'
there
dogs.
There you go, like, yeah. I like to see the dogs and the kids, and that's one of the many things I love about social media.
You know, in modern-day politics, it's a tool in the campaign toolbox that you must be doing. You have to be doing. And obviously, we're seeing Donald Trump spend millions and millions of dollars right now on Facebook advertising in key states, including in Ohio. So certainly, social media, as we've talked many times, that it is such a critical piece, whether you're running for a local judge or you're the president. It's one more piece that I think every candidate on both sides has to be doing.
You know, obviously the president's tweets equal breaking news. The person I would say the closest to that here is actually not a candidate per se. I think it's Dan Hills.
Sure.
Like Dan Hills, the FOP president for the Cincinnati Police, when he says something on social media, often it's news.
Well, no doubt.
So there's different ways to use it.
No doubt.
I want to stick on the judicial because law and order is such a critical piece to citizens. The Democrats, I thought, did a tremendous job in 2018 of coordinating campaign around their judicial, and they were very successful. Is that the type? I mean, without getting too far in the weeds,
yeah.
Could we see the Republicans do something like that to where all the judicial candidates get together? When we say coordinated campaign for kind of folks out there, it's a little in the weeds, but it's for basic purposes, it's where candidates in a party or all come together and pool their money, and then an independent, essentially campaign manager or arm goes out and does mailers or ads or whatever for the entire slate or those candidates who have paid into it. Can you see that? Could we see that happening on the Republican side?
Sure. Sure. And you know, we've talked about those things. We've done some of those things in the past. I think, looking back again at 2018, the Puraval campaign, despite it being a losing campaign, did a really nice job of incorporating the judges. Kudos to them. Yep. For putting that all together and working and connecting everybody together that way. I think that partly came out of the Puraval effort or the Puraval's role in the courthouse, but it's something that we could do better. And you know, it requires a little bit of loss and control, which is hard for candidates, especially some of our incumbent, more entrenched people who just kind of want to do their own thing and are unsettled by a team kind of concept. So this is something we've been preaching. Look, I'm not giving away any state secrets. We've been meeting with our 2020 judges for 3 months already, and that's mm-hmm. unprecedented that we meet this early. So we're looking at everything we can possibly do up and down the ballot to make a difference.
I mean, is this for you right now? One last question, I think. I mean, we have to let you go. But
sure.
Like, is this every day for you? Every day is this election. These are all your calls. Is it that intense already?
It is. It's intense. And it's funny, Sherry, you asked me that because my wife said to me just last week, this seems more intense for June than it typically is. And there's no doubt it's intense. And there's this feeling for Republicans that, you know, we're slipping away. There's just no question in Hamilton County, and we're pushing back. But I think you're going to see Saturday that we're going to have a really good rally. I think there's a lot of pent-up energy to change that. So I think that's what it is. But yes, it's every day. I think I've gotten 20 texts just as I'm sitting here. Honest to God, my phone's going nuts.
So Sharonville Convention Center on Saturday, right? And so it's an indoor venue. Is that right? Because I think it's going to rain.
It's an indoor venue.
Okay.
Shocking that it's going to rain.
It's where you have the annual pancake
yep.
breakfast,
right.
Which is always a huge Republican fundraiser, and a who's who of Republicans are at that, and you always usually have a big speaker. Alex, you know, it's great. Thanks so much for coming in on this. And I had one other question. I can't remember what it was now. Oh, you know what? This is one other thing I want to ask you about. When we talk about 2020 and we talk about 2020 in this area, you can't not talk about the first congressional district. The Democrats, the DCCC is once again very bullish on that district. How does Steve Chabot, fend off and win again?
You know, one more election and one more time where people underestimate Steve Chabot is the way I see it. Steve Chabot has a record of winning elections in this region. I'd wonder who's been as successful. He's beaten John Cranley twice. He's beaten Roxanne Qualls. He's now beaten the fresh, shiny new object from the Democrats. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I just mean it in a political way. I'm being respectful of Mr. Pureval, but you get my point.
Yep.
He's been successful time and again in that seat. He beat a Driehaus in that seat. Now, I know the line drawing and everything else, but there were a lot of people in September of last year that thought that Steve Chabot could lose that seat to Aftab Pureval, and he didn't. He won, in a fairly comfortable fashion. So, look... Steve's a guy who's out there doing, a lot of town halls again. He's out there raising money. He had a really nice event last week that I attended. I don't want to say we don't worry about him, but we know Steve is this candidate who keeps winning. So, I get this kind of chatter sometimes too, by the way. Is it time for him? No, not from my perspective. As a party leader, my job is to win races, and Steve Chabot's a proven winner. And I'm excited about him running again, and bring it on, I guess, is what I say to the Democrats.
Do you think he might have a primary challenge?
I know there's been chatter about that. I've heard it myself. I don't know of anybody who has told me they intend to fully primary challenge him. I think it would be a mistake to primary challenge Steve Chabot. Primaries are won on the fringes, on the left and the right, and there's not anybody who's going to get more to the right of Steve Chabot. So I don't think anybody would be successful in a primary against Steve Chabot. I think it would be a mistake to try.
A lot of that chatter has, I'll just say it because I've heard it quite a bit, has been around City Councilwoman Amy Murray as a potential primary challenger. Have you had a chance to talk to Amy about that? Has she brought that up to you?
And I love Amy Murray. We're good friends. I talked to her today. I saw her this morning. I'll be with her Saturday. I think she's terrific. She's got a great future in the party. I have talked to her about it. I'll probably just leave it there.
Yeah.
I think based on what I've already said, you can figure it out what I've kind of said. But on the other hand, Amy's a great friend of the party, and she really has a future in our party. We'll leave it there.
She's term limited out of council.
She is, unfortunately, for the citizens of Cincinnati. They lose one of the few common sense voices on the council.
If I had a countdown clock, and I might get one now, but I realize that it's on an app, it would be for the council race. But okay, 2020 first.
I'm going to put that in, and I'll tweet that today. How's that?
Well, there's going to be six seats open there, and nine technically, but six incumbents are termed out, and... who knows? Maybe that is an opportunity.
We're going to have a hard time because they're doing such a good job down there. I say this with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek. It's chaotic down at City Hall. I think we've got a real chance in 2021. Thank you. So we'll see. But I like our chances to at least hold on to the two and maybe add one or two.
Yeah. Alex, thanks again. Thanks so much. And we'll be talking to you some more and down the road here towards 2020.
Always enjoy seeing both of you. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, thanks to Alex T for coming in, it's funny to hear him talk about. Here we are in June of 2019, and already feels like he's sprinting to the November 2020 election. And I'll tell you, I'm hearing that from other people too on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, and you're already starting to see some of these state house races, some primaries heat up, and obviously the Hamilton County Sheriff's primary. And whew, it's going to be a doozy.
You know, honestly, I mean, we mentioned it there, but it used to be June would be quiet. Alex's wife was 100% correct. We would be having like a really quiet June and July and kind of doing like a bunch of catch-up stuff. And I, but I see you on the phone and what you're working on right now, and it's super intense for 2020. And it's like, this is new that it's like this right now at this point in time.
I'm excited about it. Better knock out our vacation time now, because I think when we come out of August, we're going to be literally in a dead sprint through the fall all the way through 2020 until November 2020. So might as well knock out our vacation time now. On that note, let's switch gears. Let's have some fun, Philly. He smiles. Phil, how you doing, son?
Pretty good, Jason.
I just want to hear you talk on the podcast.
Jason calls a lot of people son, by the way. It's not just Phil.
I get that from Marty Brenneman. You got a That's So Cincinnati moment of the week for us, Sherry?
I feel like my moment this week is I went to the
Wait. Phil? Where were you, Phil?
So Cincinnati.
A little late over there. You went to a
Carrie Underwood concert at U.S. Bank Arena.
You are a Renaissance lady. You can put many different hats on and mix it up with, you know, just many different people.
That's like the old, you know, the old Idol, right? Like back in the day when Idol was huge and watching it and everything. So it kind of stemmed from that. But I have to say, this city can bring the country. And I think that's something that's very Cincinnati, or That's So Cincinnati.
So Cincinnati.
I mean, it was
good one, Phil.
Parade of cowboy boots and like it's the hats and people, they went all out for this and it was good people watching.
Did you wear a cowboy hat?
Not a hat.
Did you wear cowboy boots?
Oh, yes. It was hard. Nice. You know, I like my heels. It was hard, but I.
Well, cowboy boots have heels.
Little ones. I bought.
Not like 10 inch ones like you like, right?
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
That's okay. Correct. So, and it was pouring down rain, so it worked out. But I bought the cowboy boots. 3 or 4 years ago, I ran the Nashville half, and it was an absolute monsoon running that race. You had to put on a baseball hat, and you had to look at the ground, and you could not see, you know, 2 seconds in front of you, and you just did it. Like, I literally ran a race through Nashville and saw none of it. You just had to get through it, and I have, and then the next day, like, you're out and about and having fun, and you wear your medal, and you did it, and that's the day I bought my cowboy boots, and I never wore them until this weekend.
Nice. That's interesting you bring it up, that Cincinnati can bring the country, because I've never, ever thought of Cincinnati as a country music place. You think of Nashville. I even think of, like, Columbus as you're going back to its once moniker was it's an old cow town, and it's where all these small town people from all over Ohio migrate to and live and raise their families. But I've never thought of Cincinnati as country music. And you're telling me that we can bring the country.
Oh, no. I think these big concerts come through U.S. Bank Arena. If this one wasn't sold out, it was darn close. Like, not a lot of empty seats in there. And I mean, people, when I said I was going to see her, everyone's like, ooh, not a good night for Riverbend. And I'm like, she's at U.S. Bank Arena. And they were like, yeah, she can fill it.
Interesting. Here's my So Cincinnati moment of the week. Phil is on it. He's on it. I sound like our previous host when I said it. He's on it. My So Cincinnati moment of not just the week, the month, but the year. Dun, dun, dun.
I don't know what's coming. Oh, my God. Okay.
What are you getting ready to hit a button there, Phil? Thank you. Thank you.
That's reserved for Burrow, though, usually.
I know. I feel like Phil gets to pick the sounds.
Can I get another one, Phil, so I can say what my... Wait just a minute longer, and the weather. My So Cincinnati moment of the year so far, the weather.
Honestly,
This is not fun. We've almost hit the amount of rain this year that we had all of 2018. This is ridiculous.
I try not to complain about the weather. You can't control it. It doesn't usually rain the whole day when they say it's going to rain, but this is this is a lot. This is like you can't sleep at night, the flash flood, and it's causing very, very serious problems for people in our communities. Landslides, you know, MSD backups in the basement. So it's kind of fun to complain about the weather, but I try also to be cognizant of water is a very serious business.
Yes. Perfect way for me to transition to actually what I've been spending a lot of my off work time doing, and that's researching kayaks, not because of all the flooding, but because I so badly want to get into kayaking. You're into it. You've got a kayak.
I love to kayak. There's great kayaking here. You wouldn't believe it. Like all the different bodies of water have great entry points, easy to do. Did you get one?
I have not bought one yet. I've been researching the hell out of it.
You texted me from Dick's. Who goes into Dick's, looks at kayaks, and doesn't come out with one?
I went to Dick's over the weekend. I went to L.L. Bean. I went to Sam's Club. I did not go to REI, but looked at REI's website. Walmart, actually, .com has some a lot of good kayak deals. I'm closing in on it, Sherry. I'm not there. I'm not quite there yet. Here's my problem with the kayak buying process. You're not just buying the kayak. You've got to buy a roof rack for your car.
Yep.
And that's not cheap. You can find a decently priced kayak. It's just the roof rack, and then you got the life jacket, so it's the accessories, the paddle. Although, you know, there's some where you can buy the package together with the paddle and the kayak. So I'm at a little bit of a... I'm a little bit of a conundrum.
Well, all sports, the accessories make the sport and the outfits, right? Is that right? No. So, but I mean, honestly, it's worth it. It is such good exercise. And we've talked about this. You're going to be able to bring the boys out because you can rent kayaks at all these different places, like these double kayaks, and have yours too. And like, we love doing this on the weekend. I like to be outside when it's not raining. And this is a great activity. I mean, sometimes we bring our kayaks and our bikes.
Nice.
Like we have a lot of great outdoors things here, and you have to have the things that go with it, the bikes and the kayaks. And
where's your favorite place to kayak in Greater Cincinnati?
Oh, Miami Whitewater, I think. West Side, right? It's lovely. Although I went on up at Caesar Creek, a moonlight kayak.
It was
amazing. Like out on the water, everybody got quiet. You know, we're all chattering. There's a lot of people, but you know, as the full moon was coming up, we brought picnics and like it was lovely.
And 50 West Brewery out in
on the river
near Marymount, they have some kayaking tours as well. Is there you can kayak there?
They do, and they help you get your kayak out on things. And then of course you can go to 50 West afterwards, that's a lot of the different places. You know, there's the beers right there.
It's
an
experience. It's exactly. not just the kayaking. You can do beer, food, that kind of thing. Anyway.
Once you have the kayak, then it becomes a very inexpensive thing to do. But you just said that it's the initial purchase. If that's what you're worried about, I assume it's not the color that you're worried about because I spent a lot of time choosing
I'm not worried about the color.
Lovely aqua of my kayak. But yes, you make this investment. Then once you have it, you can just go out and enjoy all of these parks that we have.
Well, thanks for the advice. And if you have any advice for me out there listening world, shoot me an email at jwilliams@inquirer.com. If you want to have kayak advice, non-kayak advice, you want to talk to me about politics, you have questions, you have a comment that you want us to discuss here in this final segment, shoot me an email, jwilliams@inquirer.com, or shoot Sherry an email, scoolidge@inquirer.com, or hit us up on Twitter at JWilliamsCincy with a Y, at JWilliamsCincy with a Y, and at S Coolidge.
Sharon Coolidge.
At Sharon Coolidge, at Sharon Coolidge on Twitter.
We are always on Twitter. So like
always.
That's quite a conversation usually.
Yep. So thanks so much again to Alex T. Another shameless plug for last week's episode. Go back and check it out. Rich Grader, from the CEO of the best ice cream brand in the world, was here in studio talking all things ice cream. Broke a little bit of news where they're going to go next. So fun stuff. And thanks to my pal, my friend, my coworker, my teammate, Sherry Coolidge. And my other pal, friend, teammate, and coworker, executive producer, and we're adding engineer because he also has to deal with the temperature in the booth here. And
a little hot today.
Phil Didion. on the ones and twos as always. We'll catch you next week. Thanks.